Welcome to the Elf Mind Podcast with me, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. Our guest this week is Chris Camillo, one of the traders featured in Jack Schrager's new book, Unknown Market Wizards. Before we start this week's episode, a quick word about our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA are the world's oldest body serving the trading community for the advancement of technical analysis and price action knowledge and education. They are a not-for-profit community open to members from around the world. The STA offer outstanding publications, talks, webinars and conferences and have partnered with some of the world's leading academic bodies to provide top-quality training and education courses, programs and diplomas. As part of our partnership with the STA, listeners of the Alphamind podcast can get a £100 or local currency equivalent discount on the cost of their superb home study course and diploma program. To find out more about this, visit the home study page at the top of the Alphamind blog. You can find that at alphamindblog.blogspot.com or just Google Alphamind blog.
Hey, it's good to have you on the show. I mean,
yeah,
my word, turning up in Unknown Market Wizards, that must have been a bit of a thing for you.
It's been really cool. It's you know, because I read those books and never really thinking, I mean, why would I ever be in one? it's really odd, and it's a really odd thing to have that opportunity. It's life is weird. When you're a trader, you just never think it's going to continue. You're like, always doubting yourself, could I really be this effective, or is it just luck, right? And after, it took me about 10 years to get confidence in the methodology and realize it wasn't just luck.
Well, listen, welcome to this week's Alphamind podcast, which has begun already. We're delighted to have Chris Camillo with us. Now, Chris is one of the names that you will find if you pick up a copy of Jack Schrager's book, Unknown Market Wizards. So following on from Marston that we had just recently, we've now reached out to Chris, and Chris has very kindly joined us on this show. And, if you read some of the background of the book, he's turned $83,000 into $21 million, which is a pretty big headline in its own right. He's not a technician nor a fundamentalist, if you believe what Jack has to say, and we'll learn more about that in this session today. And the word social arbitrage will be coming up, and how that's his methodology. And I've looked and read through, and as has Steve, and it's just a fascinating way of looking at value in the marketplace that is markets, particularly in the equity side. So, Chris, welcome to the show, and perhaps you'd just like to start and introduce yourself and giving a bit more background about your journey so far.
Happy to be on, guys. So I'm just an everyday, ordinary guy who just, you know, messing around with stocks since I was 13 years old, pretty much. It's really never been my career. I've had a career off of Wall Street, and investing for me has always been a hobby. And, you know, I guess it's been about 15 years ago that I started this thing that I now call social arbitrage investing, which in many ways is kind of like you could think of it as a pure evolution of Peter Lynch's kind of strategy from back in the 70s and 80s, right? He was more about kind of observational awareness. And there's a heavy dose of observational awareness in what I do. The difference between what I do and what Peter Lynch did back then was he used observational awareness as one of the factors in his investment decisions, right? So Peter Lynch was a big fundamental investor, right? And he was kind of an old school, you know, fundamental guy. He looked at a lot of things, PE ratios. I realized a while back that when you were able to find information that was strong enough in its ability to impact a sector or a stock that the market wasn't fully appreciating, that nothing else really mattered. And that's really my thesis, right? The entire thesis of social arb trading is trying to detect change early and then connect that change to investable opportunities and then arbitrage that change, right? And I actually don't look at anything other than that. Like, I don't look at any fundamental analysis. I don't look at stock price. I don't do any technicals. I don't look at PE ratios. I don't look at company management. All I care about is that information that I'm trading widely disseminated yet, or is it still off radar enough? And will it move the needle enough for that company more so than anything else could during that period of time when I think that information is likely to eventually come out? And if I can check all those boxes, I trade it, and you know, and I exit it the second that that information becomes what I call information parity, right? So, like I always say, I start investment when I believe there's an information imbalance, and I exit that investment at the point of information parity. And by the way, guys, none of this is an exact science, but you know, if you have to kind of write it down, that's the methodology. And I don't look at anything else. I almost wish, and now don't get me wrong, I'm not this good at playing along my own methodology, but I think the perfect way to execute on this methodology is if you didn't even know what the stock price was when you entered the trade and you had no idea what it was when you exited the trade. If you were completely blind to the price action, that would be the perfect way to execute my own methodology. I am not strong enough to do that. But I wish I was. That would be the way to do it.
I mean, that's incredible when I hear it. And, you know, I was so fascinated when I read this in the book. And it's something about it which intuitively seemed to make sense. But it also challenged me as I was reading
completely, it. Guys, it's so crazy. And here's the craziest part. So, and this is a part of the story. I don't know if Jack talked about this much in the book, but I was doing so well at a certain point that I had enough money, like $1 million, that I was able to allocate to create a system to help me do this at a higher frequency. So I created this company called Ticker Tags. And Ticker Tags was essentially buying Decahose data from Twitter, right? So we were pulling in 10% of all the world's tweets in full time. And we were trying to identify anomalies in speech patterns related to products and brands and culture and anything that would drive consumer behavior and connect those back to stocks. It was basically institutionalizing my methodology. And excuse me, I ended up spending about 4.5 years building out that company. I raised a bunch of money. I raised, I think, $4 million in addition to what I put in the company. I had all these Wall Street clients. I was working with the largest hedge funds in the world. I was working with the largest investment banks in the world, basically all the big Wall Street analysts. And I was traveling to New York every other week, essentially training Wall Street on how to do what I do for on an institutional level. And it was amazing because no matter how much data I showed them on it working, right, over and over and over again, they just couldn't wrap their head around it. I mean, they were buying the data from me and they were afraid to trade on it because they're like, well, what do you mean? We can't just trade on that alone. I was like, well, I mean, do what you want, but that's how I did it, right? And like, but it's intuitively makes sense, but actually doing it, and like I was telling you guys earlier, it took me 10 years before I finally gained confidence that this whole thing that I thought I was doing in my head was actually the reason why I was doing so well. Like up until that point, I was like, maybe I'm just exceptionally lucky. Maybe like, you know, the Nassim Taleb, Black Swan, if you read all of his books, he will talk about the fact that, okay, you know, there are outliers and some outliers in trading are just going to be the exceptionally lucky outliers. And they're doing nothing different than the people that are losing money, right? They're just the outliers. And it took a long time before I realized, no, I'm not just a randomized outlier. This actually is working and it's working consistently. And by the way, guys, you know, you might not know this, but you know that, you know, the 0 to 20 million or the 20,000 to 20 million, I think it was actually more like 20 to 26 or something like that. But I'm up 20 million this year. How crazy is that? Like I literally am up. I started this year with, I think, you know, just around 7 million or under 7 million in my brokerage account. And I've generated 20 million off that 7 million this year using Social Arb. I mean, it's been the biggest year of my career by far. And this is all after the book, right? So this all happened after Jack's book, which was crazy. There's another guy in Jack's book that reached out to me. I won't say who it is. He wanted me to protect his kind of identity, but he's in the book and he's done even better than I have done this year. Like, blew my mind. I thought I was like, okay, no one has done this. And he's done even better. I think he's up like, I don't know, 35 million this year. Just a regular guy. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, there's always bigger fish out there, right? Always bigger fish.
Yeah. I thought I was having the year of all years, right? And it's like, amazing.
Fantastic. But what's interesting to me is that when you sort of step back and think about this, it's kind of obvious. You know, why shouldn't people be just interrogating trends? And I think you've alluded to in certain one of Jack's stories he brings out was like you spot cues going on and you think, you know, is that the new trend? And then, you know, start to do something about it. I think the information's out there, right? You just need to tune into it. I remember when Google first came out, I realized that, you know, I was following the theme at the time and you could put like a little request into Google that Google prints out a report at 6 o'clock every night, you know, of all the things that have come up as news items for the theme that you were following. And I thought that was sort of super cool, but of course this is what you're doing is several stages deeper than that. But, you know, what's interesting to me is that you're bothering to do it. You know, you're committing to doing it. You're delving deep. You're keeping an eye out. And the awareness, as you say, enables you to spot trends beginning, spot trends ending with your parity thing, and just in enjoying the ride of the profit that comes in from doing that.
Yeah, and you have to look in, I mean, you can do this with any sector, honestly. I've done it with just about every sector, including banking even, which is really hard, and energy. I've had a few trades there, but like there are sectors that are more opportunistic than others. Now, if I go way, way back, I mean, I don't know, this is like 15 years ago, way back, you know, I used to look in areas where Wall Street was very naive, right? So like, you know, a lot of the people trading, you know, on Wall Street are, you know, centered in New York, right? Like maybe London, maybe New York. And I live in the middle of the country. Like I grew up in New York, but I live in Texas. I live in Dallas, Texas. And I remember seeing the P.F. Chang's trend. P.F. Chang's is like one of the first franchise Chinese restaurants in America. And it was amazing because I grew up in New York going to Chinatown having real Chinese food, right? And here I was living in Dallas, Texas. You couldn't get into a P.F. Chang's on a Friday night without waiting 2.5 hours. And I think that was so mind-boggling to anyone on Wall Street that they didn't quite appreciate that most of the country, this is the first time they've ever had Chinese food, was at P.F. Chang's. And it blew their mind. And by the way, it's not really Chinese food. We all know that. It's like this hybrid, I don't even know what you call it. It's like Chinese, influenced by Chinese food. But they don't know that. And they just figured out how to serve Chinese food to middle America. And I say middle America, basically anyone that's outside of San Francisco or Manhattan, you know, or Boston or, you know, one of these main, you know, areas. But I saw that and they didn't appreciate it. And that was one of my big investments at the time. You know, I always joke, I'm like, people are like, oh, you can only do this with small stocks. I'm like, Apple, you know, in the early days was one of my largest Social Arb trades. I'm like, oh, how is that a Social Arb trade? Everybody knows everything about Apple. Like it's the most covered stock in the world. I'm like, BS. I'm like, when the iPhone first came out, and I did a whole chapter. I wrote a book like 12 years ago called Laughing at Wall Street. I did a whole chapter on this one thing, this one observation. I mean, all of Wall Street blew it off. They were like, no one's going to use a phone without a keyboard. And what was fascinating was, you know, in Manhattan, you can't use AT&T back then when the iPhone came out. Because AT&T, the data network, didn't work through skyscrapers, right? So everybody in Manhattan was on Verizon, and you couldn't get an iPhone on Verizon. People forget that. It was only available on AT&T. So literally not a single person on Wall Street had an iPhone. None of them were able to experience, the emotional connection that people had with this machine, this like new handheld machine. I was at a party, you know, in Dallas and saw 10 people with these iPhones and saw them how the way they talked about it, the way they couldn't stop talking about it. And I was like, keyboard or no keyboard, this is the future. I just made that connection. And I'm like, I'm going all in. Like, I'm going all in on this. And you know, now everyone looks back and just thinks, well, of course Wall Street knew it. But no, they didn't. No one cared. No, everybody wrote off Apple. The same way everybody wrote off Nintendo back when the Wii first came out. And it was all about the PS5 and the Xbox. But I was at the gaming convention in Las Vegas, or LA, I forget where it was. My little brother was a gamer. And I saw firsthand the line of people waiting to play with that Wii. It was the first time you can, like, remember that it was like tennis, you know, you hold the handhelds. And I was like, this is a game changer. Like, this is it. This is a big deal. And at the time, I had 100%. 100% of my portfolio, every dollar, I sold everything I own. I bought Nintendo ADRs, which is like, you know, a tracking stock, because Nintendo doesn't really trade in the US, but they have this ADR. I think I made like 2.5 times my money in, you know, 9 or 10 months that year, when eventually the Wii sold out and you couldn't buy one, you know, lines outside of GameStop for 8 months straight. And but anybody could do that stuff, right? Anybody can see it. But are you, is your, have you retrained your mind to see what's right in front of you, or are you just going to read the Wall Street Journal about how hot the PS5, you know, at the time it was, I don't know, the PS1, I don't know what it was, like the first PlayStation, the first Xbox, you know, believe the media hype, or are you going to go out and just observe yourself?
Yeah, there's a lag with real research as well, isn't there? I mean, the normal process for traders is that there's a research process, there's a research document, and you know, we always used to say in the business that by the time you've seen the trade and stuck it on a client distribution list, it's already
totally
happened. It's too late.
Totally, and that's a big part of this, guys. Like now, you know, I tell you the story of P.F. Chang's. That was literally me going out and physically observing life. You know, now I don't have to do that. I could do near 100% of what I do. I could do on my iPhone reading Twitter, you know, and it's just, what are people talking about? You know, by the way, I have this, you know, I have a YouTube channel called Dumb Money, and that's dumbmoney.tv. And I'm on there every single day. Literally all I do is talk about, you know, how I do this. And it's like, I just work through my mental like process every day. So today I was on the show and I was talking about, travel stocks coming back, right? And like, you know, when are travel stocks going to come back? And how do we as investors, just regular old investors, get an edge on Wall Street? And what I explained was, because I worked with all these institutions, they are relying on transactional data. So they have web scraping machines. They're scraping all the travel sites. They're scraping the cruise websites. They're getting credit card data to see how many people are booking vacations and booking cruises. The problem with that is, by the way, that's cutting edge stuff, but they still have to scrape it, cleanse it. Then it moves from the data department to the fundamental department. Then, you know, if it's a weekend, it's going to wait till Monday to look at it. Then they'll look at it. They'll observe it. They'll write up a note on it. Then they'll meet on it. Then they have to get approval to put a big trade on it. Before you know it, like, best case scenario, you're looking at a couple days, right? Like, best case, a couple days. What can we as investors, how can we get a jump on that? So, like, I'm reading, you know, G-Trend data, like search data. And I'm looking at people, what are people talking about on Twitter even before they book the travel, right? So, like, how do I get an edge trying to figure out if people are talking about booking a cruise, or if they're searching for cruises but haven't booked one yet, or if they're searching for a travel agent? That means they're in the planning stage, right? So they're always in the planning stage before you're in the booking stage, right? So I'm just trying to creatively think about, I'm always trying to figure out, how can I detect something a little bit quicker than everybody else? And by everybody else, historically, to me, everybody else has been Wall Street. you know, basically institutional investors, because they have lots of money and lots of talent and lots of people and lots of resources, but they don't want it as bad as I want it. And they can't act on their information as quickly as I can act on it. Right. So I could read something. I could go all in doing 2 hours of intensive analysis and then have a gut reaction to it and just throw my trade on. I don't have to document it. I don't have to write up a report on it. You know, if I lose all my money, I don't have to have documentation of why I did that trade. You know, the SEC is not going to come to me and see, like, be like, hey, why did you make that trade? Right. Like, I'm not a hedge fund. I could do what I want. So that's the agility that we have is like retail traders. And I don't think people appreciate that.
Yeah, it's, you know, hearing you talk about it, you know, there's a few things there. I mean, first of all, what you were saying about the investment banks and Wall Street, you know, I'm thinking 2 days. I thought you were going to say 2 weeks. Because I know what it's like in that world. You know, it's
usually weeks, not days. Usually, it's so true. When I said a couple days, I am actually talking about the best fund that I know. I won't say who they are. But I know of a couple funds that are so sharp and so aggressive, and they have such good data teams that are like, you know, combination data. They're data teams that actually understand fundamentals as well. Like even them, even the best of the best, moving at full speed, that they'd be a couple days. Yeah, if you're talking about a sell side bank or kind of a traditional hedge fund, you're talking weeks, all day long.
And I mean, I've seen it all the time, and you know, and you get this thing as well. And I'm very aware hearing you of your personality. You know, you've got that visionary side to you. You know, you're like there's something about you that's a little bit Henry Fordish. You know, if I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, that sort of thing. You know, he had vision. I'm hearing you, and I've read the book about you. And it's like an edge. I mean, I do personality assessments when I work with traders, and there is a group of people that I come across that I call them wave runners. If I don't know if you're familiar with Elliott Wave, they're always wave runners. They'll get in at the beginning of a trend, at the start of a trend, and sometimes they get caught because they're in a bit too early, or it's not really a trend and it turns around, and they're often fighting against the establishment. Because their managers are saying, well, why are you getting into it? There's no evidence. And actually, they're doing it on a lot of gut
feel.
That's
totally correct. And I will say this. The only reason I'm able to do this, the only reason, and that's why I speak so freely about it, because like I know, like I could be, I have sat there in front of the smartest funds in the world for years, showed them everything, showed them my whole game plan, and they still won't do it. They still won't do it, or they can't do it. The only way you're ever going to actually do this is when you have conviction that it works, right? Like I have all the conviction that it works. Like if I wasn't me, like I have friends of mine that are very close friends. They've been seeing me do this for years. And they see every trade I make and they see all the money I make. And it literally took them years and years of seeing it to just now they're just starting to dabble. They're just like starting to dabble. But even then, they're so hesitant, even though they've seen it through me over and over and over and over, right? And they see my account grow firsthand, and they're still nervous. And I don't blame them, because unless you see it for yourself, like up close work over and over and over and over and over, you just don't have the confidence. And my biggest trade, I always talk about, so I know you guys do a lot of, it's a lot about psychological trading, right? And I have so much respect for that, because I will preach over and over. Everything I do is about having a prepared mind, right? So like if you have a prepared mind and you're like, you're 10 steps ahead of everyone else and you're running the scenarios of what might happen, right? And you're totally prepared that if this happens, this is what I'm going to do. And then you go to sleep on it and you think about it all night. You don't sleep. And the next day you think about it again. So 3 weeks later, when that thing happens, you are so prepared to put on that trade. And that's what happened, like with the, even with the pandemic, like a part of the reason why I've had such a big year is because I heavily and aggressively shorted the market at the beginning of the pandemic. And I was about 2 weeks early. I was watching the pandemic COVID come out of China, in January, right? And then early February. And I read the book Black Swan. We talked about that earlier, and I seem to love, right? And since I read that book, I have literally been preparing my mind every single day for the next big Black Swan. I mean, like, I'm trading stocks. I'm trading individual equities and sectors. I don't really trade macro, but I'm prepared to trade macro when the big one comes, right? And so I'm just waiting and waiting and waiting, right? And I know it's a matter of when, not if, right? And so when that started to come out of China, it was like something went off in my head. And it was, is this the one? Is this it? And so I just started getting obsessive. I wasn't sleeping. I was translating Chinese newspapers at night into English, trying to figure out how much of this was real, how much of it wasn't real. And all I kept telling myself every day was the market will never recognize an anomaly until it's already happened. It could be coming straight at them. We could have an asteroid coming spiraling towards the Earth. And they could come out on the news tomorrow and say, there's an asteroid, it's coming towards the Earth, it's going to hit us in 5 days. It would take 2 days at least before anybody would take it seriously. Because, come on, an asteroid, it doesn't, if every scientist said, no, this is really happening, people are just not going to believe it. And that's what happened with this pandemic. The evidence was right in front of you. You could run the scenarios. I was like, how, if I study, and I started studying every pandemic that had happened, right, in history. I was like, how does this not turn into a bad scenario? The only thing in my head was, how bad does it get? I was like, it's unstoppable. It's physically unstoppable. It's almost a guarantee that this thing is going to come to America and go into crash financial markets. But in the back of my head, how come no one else is seeing this? It was crazy. I'll never forget on CNBC the day that it was so obvious we were going to get crushed, and the market fell 2%. It was a 2% move. And all they talked about was, this is the buying opportunity we've been waiting for. If you haven't been in on this market, this is the one. And I was literally watching it. I was like, I think I have it on my phone, like taping the television that day, thinking, this can't be happening. I was like, am I mentally insane? I'll never forget. It was like a Thursday or Friday, and I put on the biggest short of my life. I had already put on one of the biggest shorts of my life the week before and lost a bunch of money that weekend, right? So you get a little damage, but I was like, oh, it's really coming this time. And I put it on, and that was it. That was the first weekend. The market finally started to spark. And then as soon as I saw a little bit of like proof that what I thought was going to happen was happening, I just went all in on it. I was buying S&P puts. I was shorting millions of dollars of the market. Before you knew it, I made more money in 2 weeks than I had made in 4 years, 3 years, right? And that kept going. And then all I was thinking was, God, now there's noise. There's like massive panic and noise. And I got to stay ahead of this. I'm like, okay, but why is Amazon down? Why is Peloton down? Like in a pandemic, all the gyms are going to close. Wouldn't this be like the ultimate story? Like if you were to write, like what's the perfect storm for Shopify and Peloton and Amazon? Literally the perfect storm. You would write a book about it and it would be a pandemic hits, right? And be like, but these stocks are getting crushed. And I'm like, why are they going down? They should be doubling right now, right? Like, and so I went really, really heavy into what I thought were stocks that were going to benefit from the pandemic, but they were just being brought down like everything else. And it took a few weeks for the market to kind of catch on to that. But eventually the market caught on, and I'll never forget it. The biggest trade I've ever made in my life was on Peloton, that earnings period. I think it was like late March, April, Peloton earnings, largest trade I've ever made in my entire life. It was a seven-figure options trade. I mean, normally when I trade in options, it's like, you know, $50,000, $100,000. If it's crazy, it's $200,000 of options. But I had seven figures in options that if I was wrong, I was going to lose $1.5 million that night, right? And I had never been so nervous. And I was like, I probably put 100 hours of research on Peloton. And I was calling them every day, asking them, are you sure there's not supply shortage? I was trying to figure out, how does the market not see this? Because they weren't advertising. I was like, the entire reason why Peloton's an unprofitable company is because they have to spend all their money on advertising, but they stopped advertising. And nobody else realized that they stopped advertising. And they're selling more bikes than they've ever sold. This is going to be the craziest earnings ever. And sure enough, earnings happens. And they're like, well, we stopped advertising, so we're now profitable. And Wall Street was like, you're profitable? I was like, it's almost like it gets to a point where you realize that the Wall Street is not only, you don't only have an edge against Wall Street, but they're just terrible sometimes. Like, they just literally don't even see what's right in front of their face. So like when people are like, Chris, how do you do this? You must be really smart. You must, I'm like, no, I'm just like, I'm not as bad as the rest of Wall Street. That's all. I'm just not that bad. Right. I just see the obvious things and I put my money behind these things and I don't let myself watch. I don't watch CNBC. I don't read the Wall Street Journal, except occasionally when I want to like understand, has the market seen what I've seen? Right. Like you want to go through that vetting process of, or do they know what I know? Like that's the only time I'll read it or watch it. But like, I literally do not consume financial media at all. Like, it's like you would, I have no clue what they're talking about, like in the financial media world, like right today.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast. Just a chance to quickly tell you about our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts. The Society of Technical Analysts, the STA, are the world's oldest body for the advancement of technical analysis and price action, education, research, and knowledge. They provide outstanding services for their members, including top quality education programs. And as a not-for-profit body, they are not there to rip you off, just provide outstanding insights and learning. So please do check out the STA. Their website is sta-uk.org. Now back to the podcast. See, I'm really fascinated about this. And I think you're doing something you're not even aware of, which is personality arbitrage. Okay. Most of the people on Wall Street are the opposite personality to you. They're very logical. They're very evidence-based. And they need that degree of evidence that, and they're very risk averse. You know, they're obviously risk-seeking to a degree, but, you know, it's somebody else's money usually. It's not theirs. And, you know, they don't want to look stupid by losing it. So they wait for the sure thing. So, sure, you know, most of them got into Peloton probably far too late.
That money, that thing you just mentioned about money is honestly the most important thing. I'm glad you mentioned it because I don't even talk about it that much. But if there's one thing I could tell someone to do, to be able to be a great investor, it's open up an account. I don't care if there's $100 in the account, but I call it the other people's money account, right? And what I mean by that was the money that you put in that account should be money that is specifically supposed to grow 100 times itself, right? So like, if you think of every dollar as $100, meaning like, I don't ordinarily clip coupons to save $2, but if saving $2 is $200, all of a sudden I might want to clip a coupon. Or, you know, I don't really like mowing my yard. I'd rather pay $40 a week, but I wouldn't pay $4,000 a week to mow my yard. If you think about that $40 as being $4,000, because, you know, what I did in my earliest, in 3 years, I made 100 times my money. When I turned that $20,000 to $2 million, the reason why I made 100 times my money is because I was making really bold moves that I believed in levered options. But I could never do that just with my regular savings account, right? But I had this account that was designed to take big risk on things I really believed in. And if you could start thinking of every dollar as if it was $100, you'll start finding all this money in your life. Like, okay, people always say like the coffee. Well, people enjoy coffee, get it. But like, if it's worth $3, fine, but is it worth $300? Probably not. Do you want to get your hair cut maybe a week, you know, an extra week between haircuts, right? Whatever it is, or maybe you want to buy a big screen TV, maybe wait an extra 6 months and get that big screen TV for $200 less. It's the equivalent of $20,000, you know, 10 years from now, if you can make 100 times your money. So if you could open up an account like that, you're able to make these really bold decisions, like the one I made on Peloton, where you're not afraid to lose the money, because it's like, hey, it's not money I was supposed to have anyway, right? It's just literally money that I only have because I wanted to have this. I call it the big money account, the account where you're going to get rich, right? Like this big money. And it's totally separate from the way you think about your retirement money or your family savings or even your normal investment account, right? And this is money where you can take big risk, and it could be in the stock market or, you know, your really smart friend from college who's finally starting up his own company that you just know this guy's going to kill it or this girl's going to kill it. And, you know, you don't have $10,000 to invest in them. Maybe you pull it from that account. And it's psychological, right? Because I think once you have money that you're willing to take risk with, all of a sudden it gets really easy to make a lot of money, right? Like, but our brains don't work in such a way. Like you guys probably know that study where you're not willing to take like risk even when the odds are in your favor, because your mind, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, dude, if you tell me that if I have a, I don't know what it is, like slightly better than a 2-to-1 chance of making, you know, whatever, slightly better than 50-50 chance of making more than double my money, I'm going to put whatever it takes on that. You know, even though I'm probably, you know, almost 50% chance I'll lose it all. If there's a 51% chance that I make more than 2x my money or whatever it is, like I need to do that every time. But people don't do that. They won't do that until it gets to like 90%, which is so irrational because people don't want to lose money.
That's getting back into the Nassim Taleb thing, because he talks about that in Fooled by Randomness of taking the fat tail trade.
Yep. Yeah, you're correct, because they don't really appreciate the fact that, okay, there might only be a 1 in 100 chance of this thing happening this year. But if it happens, you make 500 times your money. So even though it's only 1 in 100, you make 500 times your money. So you've got to take that every time, knowing that at some point in the next 50 years, it's going to pay off, and you're going to win ultimately. And the market, the psychological aspect of investing makes it so that you get an edge with that. But I will say something different though, that this year, with all these new Gen Z or younger millennial investors coming in from Robinhood and stuff, like this year, this whole new generation of investors, they don't think like the old school. Like they're willing to take risk. It's crazy. Like they're coming into the market at a time when they're almost expecting stocks to double. It's so weird. Like I don't know how this is all going to end, but right now, and that's why like on my channel, Dumb Money, like we have a pretty big fan base because they're willing to do this stuff, right? Like a year ago, there was no one willing to think like this and do this stuff. But these younger investors, they've seen Tesla, right? They've seen these companies, man, go from nothing to huge overnight. So they know it's possible if you pick the right ones, right? So they've seen it happen. And they've seen it happen quickly. Like our generation saw it happen, but we saw it happen over like, you know, 10 years. We'll see a stock go from nothing to everything. These days, you're seeing these things go from 0 to 100 in no time. It has an imprint on your psychological mentality of how you think about what's possible.
I want to go back to something just slightly off piece from what we're talking about, but not completely unconnected, because I'm really curious whether this fits into your method, your vision. Now, obviously, to anyone listening into the future, this episode of the Alpha Mind podcast is happening just about 2 to 3 weeks after the 2020 US election. We have no idea what comes next at this point. We're in kind of mid-November. But I was obviously sitting up that night. It was midnight in the UK or early morning, 2-3 o'clock. It was a night where I was sort of sleeping like everyone else in fits and starts to see what was happening. And I looked at my Twitter, and it was kind of everyone else was almost at that point, you know, saying Trump's miles ahead. This is a shock. He's going to win state, that state. And you put something out that said, no, this isn't over at all. And it wasn't based on a political view, clearly, because a few people, as happens on Twitter, came in and criticized you. And you just very, I thought, very succinctly stated that you know, a lot of the votes aren't counted yet. And was that the case? Was it, were you doing that same process with that?
Yes, that was the one of the hardest. I tweeted, I'm calling the election for Biden. And it was literally right at that moment when the whole world was like, oh my gosh, Trump is going to win. Because he won Florida, right? And like, it looked like he was going to win Florida. And people were like, wow, he really is crushing Biden in Florida in areas where Hillary, I mean, Trump got like in Southeast Florida, Trump only lost by 15% instead of the 30% that Hillary beat him by in what should have been Biden's strongest area. But they were, everybody, it's all about noise. People were so caught up in the noise of the big headline story, and all the betting markets were turning towards Trump. And my mind was blown, guys, because all I was prepared, my mind was prepared to look at one thing and one thing only: suburban votes. That's it. I knew that in every single state of America, you have people that live in urban areas and people that live in rural areas. But suburbia is a way of life. And if you live in suburbia in New York or suburbia in Florida or suburbia in California or suburbia in Texas, suburbia is suburbia. And it's the one data point that I thought, if I can get an early read on what was happening in suburban districts, that I could extrapolate that across the country, and that would be the deciding factor. So in Florida and North Carolina and I think Georgia and Texas, there were a bunch of suburban precincts that were reporting. And in almost every single one of those precincts, Biden was doing better than Hillary by a pretty good margin. And I said, that's all I need to know. That's it. I was prepared that was going to be the deciding data point. And that's when I put the tweet out. Now, it was gut-wrenching to put that out when it was so clearly obvious to everybody else that Trump was going to win this now. And everyone had this feeling in their stomach, like Trump upset last time. So, of course, he's going to – now they were getting that same feeling again. But you see, that feeling – that's a bias, right? That's not real. The past has nothing to do with today. That's just a psychological bias. So I put that out, and I I looked 10 minutes later, I checked my Twitter account, and I'm normally, you know, I got nice followers, and people were pretty nice to each other and stuff. Boy, people started, they were like, Chris, I've been following you, and, you know, you've had a great year, and you're right about a lot of stuff, but this is a huge mistake. This is going to impact your reputation. And this is like, what are you thinking? Like, this is not going to age well. And like, and then of course the rest of the night, everything started to look more Trump and Trump and Trump. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to open my laptop anymore. I'm not going to open Twitter tonight. I'm not going to do any of that. And I did have some back and forth with my friend network. We had a couple steak dinners were bet over text messages that I was going to be right or wrong. But I really believed it, guys. And listen, we called Trump in 2016 at my company Ticker Tags. We were the first in the world to call Trump based on real-time exit polling. And I won't get too into it, but we were basically polling and waiting mention frequency of people talking about voting for Trump versus voting for Hillary. It was an imperfect methodology, but it was showing a much stronger favor to Trump than anyone had anticipated. And we called the election for Trump at, I think, 3 p.m. Eastern on Election Day. No one in the world had done that. We did the same thing with Brexit. We got a little bit of notoriety at our firm for doing that, using the same exit polling methodology, social exit polling, that is, creating buckets, weighting the buckets, based on other elections, based on other like regional elections. And we called Brexit first in the world. We say first in the world to call Brexit. Now, since then we sold the company, and you know, one of the last conversations I've had at Ticker Tags before I left was one of the world's largest hedge funds was actually in conversations to use that same methodology to kind of do polling on this election, the 2020. I don't know what ended up happening. I'm no longer... in that company that we sold it to. But I had some confidence coming out of those last two elections, and I'm glad I called it now. I mean, now it's like people can't believe I did it. And they're like, oh, you just did that because you thought it was a 50-50 chance to, you know, be to have an outcast thing that no one else would do and you would look good if you did. I'm like, I'm not going to put my 20-year reputation on the line if I thought it was 50-50 chance. I knew it wasn't a lock, but I felt really good about that pick.
But that's a great example because that is almost like a snippet of almost everything you do. You're not there to be deliberately obtuse or to deliberately take an opposite view, but you're just looking at things that other people aren't looking at. And everyone else is waiting for the evidence and going with the noise.
Exactly. You know, when I'm looking at things that I think matter that other people don't fully appreciate. And it just happened to be the suburban vote this election. And of course, now you have all these articles coming out about the suburban vote. Like, no one was writing articles before about the suburban vote, you know, but like now everyone's writing articles about it. You know, with investing, it's often the focusing on culture and focusing on human behavior more, because I think that Wall Street tends to underappreciate cultural change and behavioral change. And so if I'm able to early identify a cultural change, like I'll tell you a funny one. You know, I bring this up in meetings all the time, and I don't know if I should or shouldn't because it's like a bit of an awkward subject. But you know, there was a huge cultural shift, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, 8, 9 years ago, away from traditional bras to what we call the bralette, okay? So from an unstructured bra from a structured bra, which is what Victoria's Secret became famous for over multiple decades, to wearing an unstructured bra, like just a piece of cotton that had no wires in it. And then we call that those bralettes, right? And so, or wearing no bra at all. And so that was a cultural shift that was global that we identified at my firm Ticker Tags, and we were really proud of it. And we were tracking, you know, this conversational volume of people talking about not wearing bras or wearing bralettes. And we came out with a research report that was basically like, this is going to be death for Victoria's Secret, because they built their entire brand around the push-up wired bra, right? And so sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And it destroyed Victoria's Secret in part. And so like, just if you're able to capture just one thing like that once a year, that could be enough to be the difference maker in your portfolio. I mean, you know, I shorted Victoria's Secret all the way down through those years when it was getting crushed.
Listen, people, see what happens when you start to pay attention, yeah? You start to, there's observational awareness stuff. So where did it all start for you? It started at the junkyards, at the junk shops, and you started to observe trends there? And
well, actually, funny enough, when I was a kid, I was a garage sale. I don't know if you do this in Europe.
Yeah, we have jumble sales and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was really like a hustler. Like when I was 12, 13 years old, I would ride my bike and take public transportation, buses all around the city to garage sales. And I would try to identify the garage sale every Thursday and Friday that was most likely to have mispriced merchandise, because I found out that garage sales and estate sales, it's really more estate sales, were managed by older women. And, you know, those women were really good at pricing antiques and like silver dishes, you know, silver and china and stuff like that. But they were really bad at pricing, you know, train sets and men's watches and, you know, anything that was male oriented. So I would arbitrage estate and garage sale merchandise, and I would find people, dealers. This is pre-eBay. There's no eBay at the time, you know, when I was doing this in the 80s and 90s. And I would find people to buy this stuff from me, and I would just, you know, make cash arbitraging garage sales. And so I was doing that. And one morning I got this, I would go to Snapple. I would get a Snapple lemon flavored iced tea every morning at the 7-Eleven. And one morning I walked into the 7-Eleven and they didn't have any. And I was like, where's all your Snapple? And it was like, they only had like two little tiny shells of Snapple when they used to have two refrigerator doors. And they said, well, now we have to have more space for Arizona iced tea and all these other brands. And I was like, oh, okay. And I talked to my older brother. I was like 13 years old. I don't know, 13, 14. I said, can I make money off of this if I like, I don't know what the opposite of buying a stock is. And he said, yeah, you can short a stock. You can buy puts on a stock. And he taught me how to do that on Snapple stock. And sure enough, that was the first, Snapple was one of the hottest stocks back then. And that was the first time they had ever had bad earnings because they were building inventory in the channel because a lot of the retailers were starting to give them less shelf space because Pepsi and Coke were coming out with their own versions of iced tea, all the Snapple, you know, mimicky products. And that's when I realized that even as a kid, I could see things that, you know, the professionals either weren't seeing or just weren't allowing themselves to see. And that's what kind of kicked off my whole, call it investment. Yeah.
It's like an instinct, right? It's like an instinct. And it's actually also being bothered to do something about it, because most people just might see something and nothing then happens. But I think I had a friend of mine actually that did something similar. He used to go to Jumble Sales, and I used to be dragged along with him. And he used to grab old cameras, like antique cameras with bellows and things.
Yep.
And then he moved on to, he had shelves of these things, but they were worth thousands. And he paid pennies. And then he went into like Goss porcelain. And I'd be dragged around looking for Goss porcelain for pennies. But they, the things were there. And he's now got a multi-million business or more. Because he...
My thing was fans. I used to buy all the old fans. And they weren't worth a lot of money. But I could usually buy these fans for like a dollar. And I would sell them for like $20 or $30 or $40 or $50. To this guy who's called the Fan Man, and he was in Dallas, Texas, and he was like one of the biggest antique and collectible fan dealers in the country. So I was like, I would buy every fan I can get a hold of for next to nothing, and he would give me 20 to 50 bucks every time. And it was like this one, it was like nobody knew that these fans were worth money, you know, it's just like a stupid little thing. You have to know where to arbitrage.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with you, and I mean, you can, and going back to one of Steve's questions about just your personality type, I remember when I started getting into what I now see as my purpose, you know, rather than being a broker and all that sort of stuff, that was one thing. But I then started to go into, you know, the coaching, mentoring, sort of personal management side and development of self. And whenever I used to talk about it, I remember even being in a trading room, one of the big heads, we used to talk about what I was starting to do. And he says, Randall, whenever you start to talk about this stuff, you just light up like a Christmas tree and you just don't stop. And actually, you have that manner as well. You've just got this energy and it's purpose-driven. There's the passion there. You've developed this niche that actually when you start, like I say, when you step back, it's so obvious, right? You're ahead of the game. You're ahead of the street. The research is real time. And the trading decisions are real time based upon what you're picking up in this new way of looking at research, right? Social media, and I'm sure that the youngsters are listening in, probably making huge amount of notes, thinking, okay, what do I need to look at? Well, I'm going to start following things more closely in my TikTok and my all the things that they look at that we don't even know the name of, right? They're following stuff.
Did totally. I did a trade on roller skates because roller skating became a TikTok trend this year. And I bought Zumiez because they were one of the few places you could buy roller skates. You know, like you could literally find stuff on TikTok. I mean, one of my biggest trades of the year was those ladies who have the Netflix show called, God, I forget what it's called now. It's like Organizing Your Closets and stuff like that. And they have a deal with the Container Store. And the Container Store went up 500%. A lot of that was in like 2 months because of this show was the main, you know, main driver of that. And it was just literally, it was a top five show on Netflix and they were selling out of this stuff at every Container Store in America. That's not hard to identify as long as you just got to retrain your brain to connect the dots, right?
Well, exactly.
You know, as I hear this, And I hear your passion for this. You know what? As Mark mentioned earlier, we interviewed one of your fellow unknown market wizards earlier this week for the most recent podcast, Marston Parker, and he made an amazing announcement where he said, "I don't even like trading." His passion is what he loves, building software and building systems. And it's represented in trading, in a sense. And it sounds almost the same for you. There's a passion here. You love finding opportunities almost and spotting trends.
Yes, yes. I hate trading. I mean, trading's the war. I mean, I would die. Like, the thought of like focusing on numbers and just the stocks, it's tiresome. I get so burnt out on that piece of it. The piece that I love is like the treasure hunt. It's like every day I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking. I never know when I'm going to find that next big thing, right? And so that's what I live for. That's what I used to do when I would garage sale. It was always about not knowing what I was going to find at that garage sale. Well, every time I go on Twitter and start looking at keywords and seeing what people are buying, what they're saying, like, I never know, am I going to find the next big thing? And by the way, I'm already thinking about when is the next big global macro event that it could be and it's kind of dark, right? Because it's usually a bad thing, unfortunately.
Hopefully not an asteroid.
Oh my gosh. I hope not. But when's the next big global event, you know, that's going to be a situation, right? And you have to be looking for it, because if you're not looking for it, then you're not prepared to accept it when it happens, you know? And yeah, I love the hunt. I don't love the other stuff.
Yeah, it's the hunt, whether it's in garage sales, whether it's in Chinese restaurants, it's in the high street. It's somewhere, but it's whether it's in an election, it's stuff that no one else is seeing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not, believe me, I have no interest in evaluating management teams and, you know, financials to try to get a slightly better analysis than the other 15 Harvard grads who have been doing analysis on that ticker all month. Like, that to me is worthless. I'm not going to try to do something slightly better than them. I'm going to try to do something with that they're not even good at doing, that they're not even trying to do, right? That's where I think the opportunity is.
That's fascinating. That really is. I got to say, this has been such a great chat, and I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been fantastic. It's been, you know, I love that this, like, the energy that's flying out. It's just like, but I think what you're doing, and we know that this is an increasingly listened to podcast, you know, that some big numbers coming out of of what we're known, this reaches to. But I think, you know, there's going to be some people out there that this is going to inspire to think really, really differently. You know, to look at, you know, perhaps they've been trading, you know, the dollar or gold or something, and, you know, the sort of stuff that, you know, that all their mates are trading, or Bitcoin. But actually looking at value within society, and of course that translates into how you could apply that through the equity world. Into real life, and real life stuff is tangible. It's easier to observe. It's not stuck in this world of too heavy to read research that gives this lag for the real trade out there on the street.
I just want to say that my whole goal in life from this point on, and I everything I do in trading is for. Now, I'm doing everything inside. All my future trading is going to be inside of my foundation. So I'm really philanthropic focused. But I just want to narrow the wealth gap. I think the easiest way to narrow the wealth gap is to get more people investing, right? I think that's actually the easiest way to do it outside of politics and policy, right? If I can get the world to invest, and I think this is a way that people can connect with investing to where they feel that they have an advantage. You know, they might not be a financially minded person, and that's okay. And that's why, you know, I'm on YouTube every day on, you know, dumbmoney.tv. I have two YouTube channels, and my Twitter at Chris Camillo, at Chris Camillo on Twitter. I'm there every day just engaging people just so they get that comfort level of, hey, this is like, I'm just like them. They're just like me. I'm just like, I'm just going out shopping, looking around in my life on Twitter. What are people talking about? What's the new hot thing? Where's culture moving? How's consumer behavior changing? And then what companies would benefit from that? What companies would be harmed from that? And how do I kind of, I don't know, how do I translate that or express that in a trade, right? Or in an investment? It's that simple. So
that's fantastic. I am just one thing, and I think it's one thing I wanted to just mention. You know, you had this passion from the beginning, but it took a bit of time to get it in a way that you could actually kind of monetize it. Because I mean, Jack talks about two islands in the book.
Yes. Yeah, so I was doing this as I just said as a teenager. But then even though I had success, I fell in the trap of, well, I can't be that smart. Like this can't really be, come on. I tried to do it every other way, but my own way. So I did, you know, technical trading, fundamental trade. Like I did all the stuff. I read all the books. Right. And I didn't do that well at it. And then I just kind of got distracted by life and college. Right. And like wanting to have a life. And I didn't trade for like 10 years. And then I eventually got a normal job like everybody else. And I was like, wait a second, I'm not going to be financially independent from any job. I need to figure out how to do. And that's when I got back into trading and I started again with my own methodology. And, you know, that's when I realized, gosh, it's my way is the way that's working. And I'm going to stick with it. I'm not going to do all the other stuff. I'm going to go all in on my way, you know? And so, yeah, it was like two separate points when I had to recommit to it as an adult, right? In my 30s, I was in my I was like 30 years old when I started doing that. Now I'm 45. It's been about a 15-year run, almost exactly 15 years since I started this. So, my returns are about 86%-ish for the past 15 years. Not including this year, which is a big year. So I don't know how this year impacts that. So maybe it pushes us up towards 90% annualized. And I don't think that's going to continue, by the way. It's stressful for me to even think about trying to continue those type of returns. I'd be happy with like 20 to 30%. I'd be very happy going forward. So I'm not going to stress myself out trying to continue that. As my dollar amounts get bigger, it gets harder, right?
And very quickly, you've got a foundation. Can you mention that again, what that's doing?
I literally just opened it. It's the Camillo Foundation, and I am about to start funding it with my stocks. I'm going to move my stocks into the foundation. It's for pediatric causes. I'm really passionate. I lost my best friend when I was a child to leukemia, childhood leukemia. And I'm exceptionally passionate about, various pediatric causes ranging from autism to any type of brain disease to leukemia and cancer. But that's my focus. So, you know, my goal is, ambitious as it is, and it seems kind of ridiculous, I know, but my goal is to grow that foundation to $1 billion-plus foundation over the course of the next 20 to 25 years by aggressively investing for the foundation. And it's just my own personal foundation. So I fund it, I grow it. And you know, the nice thing about a foundation is when it grows, you don't pay taxes. So I'm going to try to grow that to $1 billion. And then hopefully, I always say, think big, take risk so that you can do even bigger things for other people. And that's really what it's all about for me. I'm finally at a point in my life where I'm financially secure, I think forever. So now I'm trying to, you know, see how big I can do this for other people.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's what a great cause as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, we'll make sure that we give that a little bit of airtime when we publish it as well. I love that side of it. You know, you've got enough money now. Let's help other people. Let's make other people's life. Let's save lives. That sort of thing is brilliant.
Yeah, and let's get people investing. Investing historically has only been for educated people from certain geographic areas and certain family backgrounds. Let's get everybody investing. Like, I want to get kids investing and just think about investing. I think kids in elementary school should learn about stocks and just companies that are doing great things. And it's just start seeding their mind with the fact that investing isn't just for rich people, you know, in certain areas of the world. Anybody could theoretically do it. And now, thanks to all the new brokerages that are free trading and they make it so easy, like, I'd love to see a world where investing was as ubiquitous as having a bank account, right?
Well, this is, I mean, this is quite ironic, what you're saying. There's a guy, you follow Pomp at all on Twitter?
Yeah, I do. You know what? I emailed him a couple times and I was like, hey, let's do something together. But I do follow that guy. Yeah.
Well, he put a tweet out this morning. There's a young English guy, just 12 years old, you know, a kid, 12 years old, who's been writing pieces, articles and content on investing and finance. And he put a tweet out overnight. This kid's sleeping now. So let's surprise him. By the morning, let's get him up on, you know, have loads of followers. And when he woke up this morning, the kid had 7,000 followers.
I saw that. And you know what? I'm going to have that kid's going to be on my YouTube channel next week, actually.
Brilliant. We're getting him on as well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's awesome. I love it. That's so great. I love it. I love it. No, I'm looking forward to it. Unbelievable. I hope that's my kid in a couple of years. I get him started young.
It's like Ender's Game, isn't it? It's like that film Ender's Game where the kids become the future generals because of the gaming nature. And like you say, they're tuned into all this social media where these signals are, right?
Totally. Totally. I love it. I think
I think it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show, right? I think there's this energy spilling over everywhere. And and I think you were just so realistic at positioning just this niche that you've fallen into by design, I think, really. I mean, driven by your early passion and purpose. And I think that if they're the message that I want to leave people with, if you open up your awareness, and of course a lot of what Steve and I do is about opening people's awareness to themselves, but also to the very breadth of the market. The message is that you look hard enough, you'll find treasure.
I love it.
There's treasure out there. So
it's been great. And I mean, I love your energy, and we could have gone on for hours, but you know, we have to wrap it up. But I'm going to tune into some money a few times. And you know, everyone, just, you know, follow you on Twitter. How else can I find out about you?
That's it. Just, you know, dumbmoney.tv has all the stuff on there on one site. So dumbmoney.tv has both our YouTube channels and my Twitter handle, which is Chris Camillo. I'm really most active just on Twitter, so just at Chris Camillo. We're at dumbmoneytv on Twitter too.
And by the way, if you make the movie that was alluded to in Jack's book, Steve and I want to be
absolutely
in it.
Absolutely. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I'll fall back up with you guys on that.
Yeah. But stick a word out on Dumb Money for Alpha Mind. Yeah?
Absolutely.
This stuff's
absolutely
real vital for everyone.
Absolutely.
So listen.
We will. 100%. I already did today, actually, on our show. But we will again when you have it up and airing. So we'll promote it.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get you on the show again. It's been an absolute pleasure. And actually, you're the second person in a row that says I hate trading.
I love it. I do hate it. I hate that piece of it. I like the fun stuff.
Yeah, the money's good.
Oh, thank you guys so much. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Yeah, been a pleasure. Good luck. All the best, Chris.
Thank you for listening today, and thank you to our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. Again, you can find out more about their excellent services, education programs, and courses by visiting sta-uk.org. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to rate us and review us on iTunes, Spotify, or whichever service you've used. More ratings and reviews helps other people find out about the Alpha Mind podcast. You can also connect with us or follow us on social media at AlphaMind101 is one of our Twitter handles, and at AlphaMind102 is the other one. You can also view our blog page, alphamindblog.blogspot.com, where we have lots of articles, information about the podcasts, and pages of books and other podcasts, which we highly recommend. Finally, if you want to know more about us and our services, please go onto our webpage, alpha-mind.net, or go to our individual pages, alpharcube.com and markrandallconsultancy.com. That just leaves us to say have a great week, and we look forward to you joining us for future podcasts. Thank you very much.